compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. Got a little, personal security item I want to share with you. Because you never know, right? This is from the New York Times. You probably have heard of these AirTags that you can buy. Remember that when the Tile came out some years ago, it was like this little square that you can attach to your car keys or to your phone or computer. And that way you'll be able to track it, kind of a low jack for your car keys kind of thing. Well, Apple, they're in on this, and you may already have one or more of these. It's called an AirTag. It's a 1¼-inch disc. It's got location tracking capabilities, and it helps you keep track of your stuff. That's the way Apple is billing it. But let me tell you about a young woman, 24 years old. Her name is Ashley Estrada. She was at a friend's home in L.A. when she received a strange notification on her iPhone that said, AirTag detected near you. She didn't own an AirTag, nor did any of the friends that she was staying with. The notification on her phone said that the AirTag had been spotted with her 4 hours earlier. A map of the AirTag's history showed the zigzag path that Ms. Estrada had driven across the city while running errands. She said, I felt violated. Who's tracking me? What was their intent with me? It was scary. She's not alone in her experience. In recent months, people have posted on TikTok, Reddit, and Twitter about finding AirTags on their cars and in their belongings. There is growing concern that the devices may be abetting a new form of stalking, which privacy groups, as you can imagine, predicted when Apple introduced this device back in April. The New York Times spoke with seven different women who believed that they were tracked with AirTags, including a 17-year-old whose mother surreptitiously placed one on her car to stay apprised of her whereabouts. Now, I got to tell you right up front, as a parent, I've got no problem with that. No problem whatsoever. So if you have a minor child who's driving, you have my encouragement to put an AirTag on that child's car or whatever car that the son or daughter is driving, so that, God forbid, if there's ever a problem, you'll be able to get to that child quickly and help them. Some authorities have begun to take a closer look at the threat posed by AirTags. The West Seneca Police Department in New York recently warned its community of the tracking potential of these devices after an AirTag was found on a car bumper. In Canada, a local police department said that it has investigated 5 incidents of thieves placing AirTags on high-end vehicles so that they can later locate them and steal them. So how does this work? These AirTags are equipped with Bluetooth technology, and they could be revealing more than widespread problems of tech-enabled tracking. They emit a digital signal that can be detected by devices running Apple's mobile operating system. Those devices then report where an AirTag has last been seen. Unlike similar tracking products from competitors like Tile, the Apple has features that prevent abuse, including notifications like the one on Ms. Estrada's phone. They said that they're going to add a few more features to prevent the tracking of people next year. My reaction to that is, how are you going to do that? Apple, if the whole point of the device is to track something, how are you going to disable the tracking and still sell that item as something that helps you track something? It doesn't make any sense to me. AirTags, they say, represent a uniquely harmful threat because of the ubiquity of the Apple products, allowing for a more exact monitoring of people's movements. Apple automatically turned every single iOS device, that means your iPhone, my iPhone, your iPad, anything that you've got that runs iOS, it is now part of this network that can locate AirTags. Even if somebody drives by you with an AirTag in his car, your phone is going to ping it. Let's see. $29 per copy. That's what the AirTag costs. There's some obligatory commentary from the Apple spokespeople. You could take a look at that if you're interested. One of whom says, if users ever feel their safety is at risk, they're encouraged to contact local law enforcement who will work with Apple to provide any available information about an unknown AirTag. Police could ask Apple to provide information about the owner of the AirTag, potentially identifying the culprit. Here's another example of the problem. After a Friday night out with her boyfriend this month, Erica Torres, a graduate student in New Orleans, was notified by her iPhone that an unknown accessory had been detected near her over a two-hour period, and it moved with her from the bar that she was at to her home. She calls the police. She calls Apple, but she never found an AirTag. An Apple representative told her that other devices could set off the alert, including AirPods. She posted a video about her experience to YouTube, and a dozen people commented about it happening to them. So this is a far more widespread problem, it would seem, than you might imagine. Ms. Estrada, who got the notification while in Los Angeles, eventually found a quarter-sized AirTag tracker lodged in the space behind the license plate of her car. Somebody got behind the license plate of her car, and in that little space, apparently there's a little indentation of some sort there, they put one of these babies on there, and whoever that person was tracking her. She was told by the LA Police Department dispatcher that her situation was a non-emergency, and if she wanted to file a report, she'd have to bring the device with her to the station that morning. She didn't want to wait, and she disposed of it after taking several photos. A spokesperson for the LAPD told the New York Times that the department had not heard of cases in which an AirTag had been used to track a person or vehicle, but Ms. Estrada said that after she posted her TikTok video, an Apple employee, acting on his or her own, contacted her, and the employee was able to connect the AirTag to a woman whose address was in Central Los Angeles. So an Apple employee steps forward, God bless him or her, to try to do the right thing and figured out who it was that put... And why would this woman in Central LA put an AirTag on this other woman's car? Who knows? Another woman was notified by her iPhone that she was being tracked by an unknown accessory after leaving the gym. This is back in November. She got home, she called the police. She was told that a report could only be filed if someone showed up at her home, and that Apple's notifications were not enough proof that she was being stalked. She later got in touch with an Apple customer service rep who was able to disconnect the device from her phone, and the device was never found. AirTags and other products connected to Apple's location tracking network called Find My trigger alerts to unknown iPhones they travel with. The AirTag product page on Apple's website notes that devices are designed to discourage unwanted tracking. And that they will play a sound after a certain amount of time not detecting the device to which they are paired. But the problem was this little feature that was added in an update that was pushed to all the AirTags by Apple. Users say that it beeps very, very loudly. So people don't want that. If you don't own an iPhone, you may have a harder time detecting an unwanted AirTag. AirTags aren't compatible with your Android phone. Earlier this month, however, Apple released an Android app that can scan for AirTags, but you have to be vigilant, download it, and use it. So if you're using an Android phone, it doesn't mean that the AirTag people are not trying to track you, but you can get that app if you want to see if they are. So there you have it. Technology. It can be your friend, it can be your enemy, quite frankly. FYI. Let's go to Marilyn. Not in Maryland, but in Rhode Island. Good morning, Marilyn.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question is, during the Mass, when we offer each other the sign of peace, when did that start? When did we start doing that? Because I'm 75 years old, and I don't remember doing that when I was a lot younger. And what I'll do is I will hang up and I'll listen to your answer.
As you wish. That sounds fine. Thank you, Marilyn. So the short answer to your question is that this sign of peace began in the early church, and historians and scholars of the liturgical development of the Mass in the West specifically, they show even down to probably like within a matter of decades when you first begin to see the sign of peace present in the liturgy or the Mass, as we say in the West. So it dates back to, let's say, I would say without having the date in front of me, let's say at least to the 3rd century. Now, you mentioned that you're 75 years old, Marilyn. So you went to the traditional Latin Mass for a time before you were probably, You were probably a young adult when the mass changed and the council ended in 1965. And within a couple of years after that, the mass had changed fundamentally from the traditional Latin mass to the new rite of the mass. Well, the sign of peace was in the traditional Latin mass as well. It still is in the traditional Latin mass, but it's not practiced the way it's practiced in the new rite of the mass, which is when the priest says, you know, or the deacon perhaps would say, show each other a sign of peace. Since the council, that became, in terms of the way it was done, very different, very, very different from how it had been done in the Roman rite of the mass. And in the prior form, the priest would turn to the people, Dominus vobiscum et cum spiritu tuo, and then he would say, may the peace of Christ be with you. And the people would respond, et cum spiritu tuo. So it was the priest giving the sign of peace to the people in the person of Jesus. So the priest at the altar offering the sacrifice of the mass is, as the Latin phrase goes, in persona Christi. He's acting, he's officiating or ministering in the person of Christ. So it's Jesus, after all, in the Gospels who said, you know, my peace I give you. So that's Jesus saying this to his apostles. He gives them the sign of peace at the Last Supper, or within that context. He gives them the sign of peace. So the proper context is, at least in its immediate form, is Jesus giving the sign of peace to his disciples. And that's how you would always find it in the ancient liturgy of the church, up to and including the traditional mass even today. So back to the Second Vatican Council. At the council, in the Sacro Sanctum Concilium document, which was the blueprint, you might say, for the modifications that took place in the mass, the sign of peace at that point then became something that not only would the priests say from the altar to the people, but the people would then say it to each other. Now, that has a biblical warrant as well. It's not as, certainly not pronounced in any way in the traditional rite of the Mass, but that has to do with, as St. Paul says, that if you have something against your brother, leave your offering, you know, before you go up to receive communion, leave your offering at the altar. He's using figurative language, and make peace with your brother first, then come back. And then you are going to be in the right position to be able to receive the body and the blood of the Lord. Now, I'm paraphrasing here. But the point is that theological reality from St. Paul also applies in this case. So that was as I understood it anyway, that was the logic behind the theological development, saying that the sign of peace should not only be given by the priest to the people, but by all the individual people to each other. So I guess there you have it in a nutshell. I hope that's helpful. 888-914-9149. How about Patrick now in Trenton, New Jersey? Good morning, Patrick.
Hi, good morning, Patrick. I came across an article. It's actually 10 years old. It's ABC News, and I never heard you talking about it, and it's kind of piqued my interest. It's a man named Gunnar Samuelson, and he's a theologian, Swedish theologian. And he wrote a thesis, a 400-page thesis, saying that during the time of Christ, there was no crucifixes, there was no crucifixions during that time. And I just wondered what you thought of that and how you would respond to that.
Yeah, I would say, although I haven't read the work, I have read other works that discuss this very issue. The confusion stems from the Greek word that's used for cross. We translate it, or Saint Jerome translated it into the Latin as crux, C-R-U-X, which is the nominative singular form, and that means cross. And the word from the Greek that he translated, for example, in John 19, where it talks about the cross and Jesus being on the cross and Jesus being taken down from the cross, the word that Saint Jerome used to translate the Greek word stauros was crux. And I don't mean crooks like robbers, so C-R-U-X. So St. Jerome, being a master not only of the Latin language, but also of biblical Greek and Hebrew, he recognized that although the Greek word, there was no word that I'm aware of anyway in Greek for a cruciform cross, like a beam with a cross beam on it, the word that the apostolic writers used was stauros, which means stake. It means like imagine like an upright pole. And indeed, it was an upright pole. But the tradition tells us that there was a crossbeam that was attached to it. So it's not incorrect to say that Jesus was crucified on a pole, but it wasn't just a pole. It wasn't, as the Jehovah's Witnesses imagine, that the Lord's feet were crucified or were nailed below him, and then his hands were sort of joined together the way you would stand in one of those, I guess they're magnetometers or whatever they are, when you go into the airport security and they make you stand in this round chamber as the door goes around and takes a naked picture of you and you've got your hands in the air. Imagine crucifixion in that position. Well, that's not how Jesus was crucified either. He was crucified with his arms out to each side. So the bare bones of the scriptural information is not sufficient to make this case. Rather, you have to look at the documentation that's available to show how did, in fact, the Romans crucify people. And they crucified them in a cruciform manner, meaning there was a crossbeam, hands extended to either side and feet nailed below. So that's the bare bones of it, but there is plenty of scholarship that demonstrates that that is the case. Another detail to look at would be there is an ancient graffito from Rome, and I'm just going from memory here. I believe it, I'm trying to remember now whether it's written in Greek or written in Latin, but it shows a crucified man with the head of a donkey, and it's not on a pole, it's on a cross. And this is from very early on, within, let's say, a century or two, or well, let's say within 2 centuries, let's say, of the actual crucifixion of Christ. And somebody was mocking a Christian by the name of, I think his name was Exominos, saying Exominos worships his God. And it was a mockery of Jesus in the form of a man with the head of a donkey, but he was crucified with his arms stretched on either side of him. So even just anecdotal details like that demonstrate the incorrectness of the claim that Jesus did not die on a cross. That's just not true. So I'll have to sort of leave it at that because I don't have any of the scholarship in front of me to cite, but it's not difficult to find. And, you know, anyway, so those are some thoughts off the top. And I think maybe he dropped. Don't know what happened. It just occurs to me in the moment that if you want to read up on this issue, as I recall, Catholic Answers may have some articles on this very topic. And if you go to Catholic.com, you could easily search for them and find them. You could use cross or stake, could be a way to word search for it. But I do believe they've got some articles and things that will give you further detail on that. Let's take a break and come back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show. I bet you're searching for those air tags, aren't you? I'll be right back with more right after this. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Two pictures I'd like you to see, both of which are front and center on my Twitter feed, which is at Patrick Madrid. Take a look. And by the way, you don't have to be signed up for Twitter to see this. Just go to twitter.com/Patrick Madrid. You can see it there. But the first one is a sign that's attached to the door of a restaurant of some sort. It says steaks and salads. And the sign says, if you're homeless or struggling because the quarantine has left our streets empty, you are not alone or forgotten. Knock on our door and ask for a manager. We will make you a meal and get you a care package. No questions asked. Someone is here 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. every day. I love that. Now, somebody, and you know, sometimes I post things on Twitter with the setting that nobody can comment on it unless it's somebody that I follow on Twitter. And I do that for the reason that oftentimes people will just say really rude or obnoxious or, you know, querulous things. And sure enough, somebody did. And, the, You know, they said, oh, that's, you know, your heart's in the right place, but that's very naive. And, you know, it's naive, I guess, in their mind to put a blanket statement like that out there, because chances are somebody will take advantage of it. So my response to the person who said, you know, that this is naive is to say, well, blessed are the naive. And I quoted Jesus in Matthew 25. Then the king will say to those at his right hand, come, O blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you? Or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and welcome you? Or naked and clothe you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and visit you? And the king will say to them, truly, I say to you, as you did it to one of these least of my brethren, you did it to me. Now that's Matthew 25, beginning verse 34. So I think Jesus's answer is the best answer to the guy who popped off with, well, this is very naive. I'd rather be naive than be in the goat category when the time comes, if you know what I'm talking about. The second picture, just above that one, it's very touching. I'd like you to see it, if for no other reason than just to be edified by it. It shows a little boy. It's hard to tell how old he is. He might be 7, 8 years old. He's in Walmart. So there's like a Redbox video machine to his right. And he's kneeling on the floor in Walmart, right up in the front area, in front of a big sign that has the pictures of a bunch of children who are missing. So he's kneeling down with his hands folded, his head is bowed in prayer, probably didn't realize that anyone was even taking this picture. He's praying in front of this poster of missing children at Walmart. And when I first saw that, I thought, oh my gosh, that's beautiful. And it reminded me of what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 18, beginning in verse 1. He said to his disciples, or rather, the disciples came to Jesus saying, who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And calling to him a child, he put him in the midst of them and said, truly I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. So if you want to be edified and uplifted, and reminded in a very good way of what it means to be like a little child, as Jesus was saying it, take a look at this picture. And for that matter, I would encourage you to share it. You know, you don't have to give me attribution. I don't even know where I found it. But grab it and share it and let other people see this, the beauty of this little boy kneeling down. He doesn't care that anybody sees him kneeling down and praying, but he's praying for these children who are lost. And I think that's beautiful. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Paul in Tampa, Florida. Good morning, Paul.
Happy New Year. I loved your show. I have a question. It has to do with the naming of popes. I'm 57 years old, so I've seen a few popes. I'm named for Paul the Sixth. What I'm wondering is, how do they come about their names? Because during the College of Cardinals, it's my understanding that none of them knows who's going to be elected. And it seems like it's a very brief time between their election and then their presentation as, you know, Pope Francis.
I think here's what happens. When you go into the conclave, and of course the conclaves, some of them can last days and days and days or even longer. Most of the modern conclaves have tended to be finished up within a few days. So going into a conclave, I have a feeling that there are some of the cardinals who realize that it's possible that they might be elected. So they go in with that in the back of their mind. Well, if I'm elected, and probably many of them would say, please, God, don't do this to me. But if I'm elected, what's the name that I will choose? And so my guess is, Paul, that they've already thought that through and they've already made their selection. Because when the conclave is concluded, when the final tally results in the selection of who the next pope will be, at that point, I believe it's the Camerlengo goes up to him and asks him, by what name will you be called? And first of all, do you accept? That'd be the first question. And if the cardinal who's elected accepts, then the next question, as I understand it, would be, by what name will you be called? And then he gives the name. I will be called John Paul, or I will be called, you know, what have you, Benedict. So that's how that unfolds. And, you know, if a cardinal goes into the conclave not expecting to be elected, and he hasn't really thought about what the name might be, you're right, Paul, he doesn't really have much time to make that decision. So he's got to come up with it quickly.
Okay. All well, right. Thank you very much for your answer. It's a good answer, and it's got to be a tough spot for them, I imagine.
Yeah, it's not a job I would want. It's not a job that I would get either. I'm unelectable to the papacy for a variety of reasons, I think, not the least of which would be my wife would never allow it. She wants me home to take care of the honey-do list. But hey, if you're interested, Paul, great movie, came out in the early 70s, I believe, starring Anthony Quinn. It's called Shoes of the Fisherman. And there's a very dramatic scene in the Sistine Chapel where the election is recreated. And the backstory is he is a, I believe he was Russian, if I'm not mistaken, or Ukrainian maybe. And he was maybe he was a priest, but he was like in the gulag. He was in the Soviet prison camp. And eventually he's released and the Pope makes him a bishop. And then he's made a cardinal, and then he gets elected pope. And the story is very dramatic, very beautiful. And the scene where the election takes place and he's chosen is well worth watching. So The Shoes of the Fisherman is the name of the movie. It was a big budget Hollywood production starring Anthony Quinn. Let's go now to Lisa in Illinois. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm just calling because this past week we've had some devastating news. Our oldest daughter has come home and told us she was expecting. She's not married. She's in her mid-20s. Okay. We're a very pro-life family, very anti-contraception. So we're grateful that she didn't do anything to the baby. Mm-hmm. But we just need some direction. She knows all of this, and she wasn't contracepting, which, you know, we're in the situation we're in. But she's in her mind thinking she can have the baby and we'll have this wedding after the fact. And, my husband is really struggling and, you know, he's thinking he can't even walk her down the aisle. So just, we're desperate for advice.
Sure. How old is your daughter?
24.
Okay. Let's begin there, shall we? Obviously, this is very painful. I can only imagine how painful it is for you because you raised her to know better and to live a certain way, and she fell, and this is the result. So I have great empathy for you, Lisa, and for your husband, and the feelings that you're feeling are natural and understandable. But let's focus on for a moment on the fact that she is an adult woman, and it's no longer your role to tell her what she can and can't do. She made a serious mistake in terms of this sexual sin. But look at the blessing that God gave you and your husband, not to mention her, in the midst of this sin. There's a blessing present in the middle of all this. And no doubt in your prayers and in your tears, you've thought about that. But I would just encourage you gently, don't forget about that. And don't let that leave the center of your focus, which is where I believe it is, that God in his generosity has given a blessing in the midst of this situation. So since she is an adult woman and she has the right to decide what she will do for herself, again, with all gentleness and respect, Lisa, I would say you need to guide her. You and your husband should guide her, as I'm sure you're doing, but also respect her decision. And if she says, I want to keep this child, then respect that. And I don't know to what extent the guy is marriageable material. He may be worthless, in which case then I would strongly encourage her to wait until she finds a good young man. But there's no shame brought upon you and your husband. There's no shame upon your family name. This is a serious mistake. But on the other hand, God is in the business of forgiving people who make serious mistakes. That's all of us as sinners. So I would just say, love her, encourage her, admonish her as necessary, but don't reject her and don't push her away and don't push this baby away, and don't treat this little boy or girl any differently than you would treat any other grandchild. Love this child with all the same affection that you would feel for any other grandchild, and things will get better. And quite frankly, I do believe that by showing this love and compassion and not pushing your daughter away and not punishing her endlessly for this mistake, it will help her to see how God loves her, because you and your husband will be modeling for her what our loving Heavenly Father desires for all of us. You know, you made a mistake. You committed a serious sin. Repent of it. Get back on the straight and narrow. As Jesus said, you know, go and sin no more. So all of that is part of the process. But by showing her love and forgiveness and the same amount of welcome and respect that she had before, I think that'll go a long way toward healing everybody, and also a long way toward her being able to have a right relationship with God, her Father, as time goes on. So those are my thoughts just off the cuff, so to speak.
So she's determined to marry this gentleman. How do we proceed with a normal wedding, or do we?
Yeah, that's another question. So I hope that everything I just said stands on its own. Now let's take up this separate question. Okay. Because this has other eventualities that we have to take into account. Is the young man Catholic, first of all?
Yes.
Okay. Does he want to marry her, or is he feeling forced into this because he got her pregnant?
They both want to get married.
Okay. For what it's worth, Lisa, and obviously for obvious reasons, I can't go into any detail, but I know of, off the top of my head, I can think of three couples that Nancy and I have known over the years who are wonderful, excellent Catholic parents, large families in a couple cases, who started off this way, where the woman got pregnant, you know, they were fooling around, she gets pregnant, they wound up getting married, and they have wonderful, lasting, beautiful marriages with many children, and they're both very devout Catholics. So it can happen that way, and all the more reason why you and your husband giving prudent and loving, compassionate advice is really going to help shape that. Now, if he wants to marry her and she wants to marry him, the fact that they have a child doesn't require that they get married, obviously. But it does, in a way, kind of facilitate it, because what better situation than to have the actual father of this child with the mother of this child living together as a family? That's the ideal situation. So if I were dad, I would approach it this way. I would say, let's make sure that, you know, that you both are prepared for this, that you both really want this, that you both are capable of entering into the sacrament of holy matrimony. And if you are, we'll help you. We'll help you get married. And then the ideal situation is in place. Mom, dad, and the baby together in the sacrament of holy matrimony. To me, that's the best of all possible outcomes. Now, you may think the guy is a jerk, or your husband may be really irked at him because of what he did to your daughter. And those are also understandable feelings, and I don't fault you for that if you feel that way. But if you can look past that and say, well, maybe this young man can rise to the occasion. Maybe he will be a good husband and father. We don't know the future. And they both manifest all the necessary ingredients to have a valid and hopefully happy marriage. I would not stand in the way of that if it were me. I would try to facilitate that.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. That's wonderful advice. It's very helpful.
I think you will find that this approach will mend a lot of fences and heal a lot of wounds. And, I mean, wouldn't it be terrible if your daughter became estranged from you and your husband? You'd never want that.
Right.
So I think this course has a lot of upside, honestly.
Okay, and I think that's the direction they want. They talk about having a big family, and they are both Catholic, and they both go to church. And But
with God's grace, maybe this will be a model marriage. Maybe they will be saints with many children who become saints, and they can all look back and thank you and your husband for your wisdom in the way you handled this.
It's not easy.
I can understand. I can understand. Yeah. You're right to feel the way you do, Lisa. I want to, you know, validate, if that's the right word, what you're feeling and your mixed emotions and your disappointment. All those things are completely understandable. But comes a time when you have to look beyond that. And I think, you know, since you asked me, I think this is the right direction to go in.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes, I needed to hear that. I appreciate it.
You got it, Lisa. I'll pray for you and your husband and the whole family. And may God's blessing be upon your daughter and this young man and, of course, this baby on the way. God bless you. Let's go to, well, you know what? Let's take a break and we'll come straight back to the phones. The number to dial, 888-914-9149. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Little COVID update for you. This from the New York Post. A judge has blocked the Pentagon from punishing Navy SEALs who refused COVID vaccines. Here's how it's being reported. A Texas federal judge has barred the Defense Department from penalizing 35 Navy SEALs who refused to get vaccinated against COVID-19 on religious grounds. U.S. District Judge Reed O'Connor in Fort Worth granted a preliminary injunction Monday in the lawsuit filed against the Navy and the Pentagon on behalf of the group of Christian active duty special operations members. O'Connor noted that the SEALs contended that the military's vaccine policy violates the religious freedoms under the First Amendment and the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. The judge, appointed by President George W. Bush, further noted that the Navy has not granted any religious exemptions to any vaccine and merely rubber stamps each denial. The Navy service members in this case seek to vindicate the very freedoms they have sacrificed so much to protect, O'Connor wrote in his letter, in his order, rather. The COVID-19 pandemic provides the government no license to abrogate those freedoms. There is no COVID-19 exception to the First Amendment. There is no military exclusion from our Constitution. If you're interested in this story, we'll have a link to it for you on the show Twitter feed, which you can find at relevantradio.com/Patrick. Back to the phones, 888-914-9149. Let's go to Kathy in Wisconsin Rapids. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning. I just wanted to talk about the mother that just called in about her adult daughter. I was that daughter. And 42 years later, my husband and I are still together. But we could not have done it without the support of our parents. I mean, we were younger at that time. And I know our parents were disappointed and they were sad and everything because we were so young, mm-hmm. but they were devout in their faith, and through their faith and probably a lot of prayers is what got us through to where we are today. We raised 5 children together and we have 11 grandchildren, but I just want that mom to know that more than ever, their daughter needs her and her husband. She needs that support. And through their love and guidance so that they have a good Catholic marriage and raise her child to be Catholic.
So, hear, hear.
I mean, right now she can be disappointed right now and sad right now, but when she sees that baby, and she should want more than anything is for a happy Catholic marriage for her daughter.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Well, that's why, and by the way, thank you for sharing that. I know it's a personal detail, but how nice it is that you're reinforcing that point that I was emphasizing, and that is that if your mom and dad hadn't loved you and hadn't encouraged you the way they did, who knows what could have happened? Have you ever thought about that, Kathy? Have you ever, daydreamed about what might have been?
We beat the odds, and I am so thankful it was because of our upbringing and our parents. My husband and I both have had, like, mothers that are saints. But through their guidance, and like I said, probably a lot of prayers, because I was 15 when I got pregnant, and we got married right before I turned 18. So we were celebrating 42 years this year.
Congratulations. That's beautiful. I guess I'm sort of in that club, although we got married February 7th, 1981. So our 41st anniversary is coming up next month. So we're not quite where you are, but we're getting there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, God bless you.
No, I am just, thank you. Thank you very much.
Now, my question to you before you go, Kathy, is not that obviously you want this to happen, but if it should happen that one of your children or grandchildren turns up pregnant and unmarried, I'm guessing, now you tell me if I'm wrong, but I'm guessing you're going to follow the same path that your mom and dad followed with you in your case, right?
Our oldest daughter was 24 when she got pregnant with our oldest grandchild. Okay. And it was my husband wanted her to move home and take care of her, and he was beside himself, but her husband, I mean, he stepped up, and he is older than her and had never been a father, and he rejoiced in this baby, and she's now 18, and oh my gosh, she is just so loved.
That's beautiful. Well, it's a wonderful story all the way around. You have so many blessings to thank God for, including, and maybe most especially, the way your parents related to you when it was your situation. Thank you, Kathy. Thank you very much. Let's go now to, let's go to Lauren in Phoenix. Good morning, Lauren.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, great. Okay. I come from a Catholic family, and I would say our family kind of, we were Sienese growing up, Christmas, Easter,
okay,
and we would go to church a few times in between those places, went to Catholic high school, fell off from the faith from probably age 18 until 38.
All right.
COVID has been an eye-opener, along with a lot of other things. So I'm back at the church with my family, and it feels wonderful.
Awesome.
My sister, my older sister, who I look up to, she's incredibly smart, wonderful human being. She's had a conversion herself in the last few years. And for a lot of our family, she's been like a John the Baptist, like just in the Word, telling everybody to start reading the Bible, you know, just getting everybody fired up. She's taking more the evangelical approach. And I mean, this, my sister, she's born again. There's no doubt about it. She is on fire for Jesus. Mm-hmm.
I know that you have a question in there somewhere. How would you phrase that question for me?
I do. I'm getting there. Okay, here I go. So she confuses me. So I'm going to Catholic church, going to reading, and I'm learning, I'm loving it. And then I have this born again sister who's not Catholic, who is, when people are dying, she's saying as Christians, we need to be there. And why aren't we Catholics rising people from the dead when they die? Jesus calls his disciples to do that.
All right, let me share with you a Bible verse that came to my mind, and this may be the very one that she's thinking about. Mark chapter 16, beginning in verse 17. And these signs will accompany those who believe. In my name they will cast out demons, they will speak in new tongues, they will pick up serpents, and if they drink any deadly thing, it will not hurt them. And that's a translation of the word poison there. And if they drink any deadly thing, it will not hurt them. They will lay their hands on the sick, and they will recover. So, I mean, that sounds to me like what she has in mind with what she's saying to you. Is that right?
That's right. However, she's taking it a step further. And when people die, like loved ones who are on their deathbed and they die, she is saying we should go to them, lay our hands on them, and they should rise.
Okay. Well, ask her if she's done that, first of all. How many people have you raised from the dead?
She's not successful just yet, but she's trying to, and she's calling all of us to do the same.
So what I would say to her is, with all due respect, that this is a statement that Jesus made, in particular about those who were present to him. St. Augustine, he was born in the year 354, so he was, you know, 300 years after the time of Jesus, and then some. And during his time, this was one of the taunts that was raised against him, and that is, where are all the miracles? How come you're not raising people from the dead? How come you're not healing people who are sick? How come you're not, you know, making blind people see and all these things? And you know what St. Augustine's answer was? He said, because those miracles are no longer necessary. They were necessary at the inauguration of the church to establish by these proofs, these miraculous deeds, that the message of the apostles was in fact true on the basis of who had sent them, Jesus Christ himself. But when those miracles were no longer necessary in God's wisdom, they began to disappear. Maybe not entirely, but they began to disappear. They were nowhere near as prolific as they were in the early church. And that's the right answer. So, you know, you could take a couple different approaches to your sister. You could sort of play along with her and say, okay, yeah, show me how it's done. Raise somebody from the dead so that I may know how this is done. And if you quote that passage to her, ask her, would she be willing to drink poison, knowing...
Oh, she would, Patrick. She would.
But we don't want her to do that.
Fire.
Yeah, we don't want her to do that, though. Yeah, that would be foolhardy. So, okay, I get it. You want to do this in such a way that it doesn't provoke her to do something foolhardy. But if it's raising the dead, I think you can just draw the line there and say, great, perfect. I love this idea. Go ahead and do it. Show me how it's done. And she's never going to do it. It's never going to happen. I mean, God, it's not impossible that God might do that, but the likelihood that it would ever happen is so small.
Pastors online with videos who show them raising people from the dead around the world.
Fakery.
What's that?
Fakery. It's not real.
Okay.
You don't have to prove anything, Lauren. That's the beauty part about this.
I find it confusing because I feel like my faith is being attacked because I don't have the same faith as her.
Don't allow your faith to be attacked. You hold all the power in this situation, not her. And you just simply focus on Jesus. He should be the focus of your life, of your faith, not whatever gifts you may have. The gifts are incidental.
Well, and she says that, too. She tells me that. Focus on Jesus. But it throws me off when I'm, you know, I'm shocked to see this sister that I've had my whole life all of a sudden literally saying we should be trying to raise people from the dead. Like, it's shocking to my family, to me.
All I'm saying, Lauren, is it doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
This is not scandal per se, okay? It's not scandalous by its very nature, but think about it this way. A scandalon, a stumbling block, that's what it means. In the Greek word means a stumbling block. And Jesus warns about scandal. Now, again, this is not scandal, but I think there's an interesting parallel here. He warns about scandal, and he says, you know, scandals will come, but woe to that man by whom scandals come. So that's half of the situation. But you have an obligation to not stumble. So a stumbling block has been put in your path. You have an obligation before God to be careful and not stumble. If somebody puts a stumbling block there and it's sinful, it's scandalous, and people stumble over it, well, that's attributed to that person's sin. I mean, that person will pay the price for that. But you also have an obligation to be nimble and not trip and fall. And my view of this, from what you're saying, is you are alarmed, you are discombobulated, you are flustered, you are unsettled. This is, in some way, perhaps, shaking your sense of peace in Jesus. Don't allow that to happen. Don't allow all of this, what I would regard to be frippery, on the part of your zealous sister. God love her. I'm sure she's a wonderful woman, and I'm sure that you love her very much. But in her exuberance, she is unsettling you and other members of the family, just don't let that happen. Just say, I love Jesus. I love his church. I receive the sacraments. I read the Holy Bible. I pray the rosary. I'm following Jesus. He's my focus. If you want to go around claiming that you're going to raise the dead someday, more power to you. I hope you can do that. You don't have to add that you don't think she ever will, but more power to you, sis. Go for it. And let me know when it happens. And it won't happen. And eventually,
and
if
I should say this about her. She's mm-hmm. doing an amazing thing. She is stirring up our family, and our family is getting our Bibles out. We're reading more. We're talking more. It's been a good thing. It's just she's on fire in just a different way. And
I hate to be the wet blanket, but it is true that God does bring good out of evil. But if she's left the Catholic Church and turned her back on the sacraments, she's not on fire in a good way. And it may be that this wandering that she's going through right now will bring her back to her Catholic faith, and I hope and pray that it does. But in the meantime, I would just advise you, don't let this fluster you. Keep your eyes focused on Christ and pray for her. Thanks, Lauren. Hour 3, right after this. Oh.